Welcome to Boston Confidential, Beantown's true crime podcast. Boston is a great city, but there's more to it than the Freedom Trail and Fenway Park. There's a startling underbelly to the city, and Boston Confidential will take you on a guided tour of the hub of the universe, Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Boston Confidential. My name's Barry McGuire, and I'm your host. I'm a 20-year private investigator on the streets of Boston, and I help run a company called Impact Due Diligence Investigations. If you need anything in terms of investigative services, feel free to contact me at Impact. If I can't help you personally, I'll certainly direct you to the right person or agency. All right, guys, let's get to it. It is April in Boston, and most people would think that means the Boston Marathon and opening day at Fenway Park, but it's really just pothole season, to be quite frank. But finally, guys, some big news from Boston Confidential. We have some merchandise to sell. Everybody has been on my back to get this done. It's taken quite a while. We got several things in the store with more on the way. The biggest item that's selling most quickly are these 16-ounce glass tumblers. Somebody told me you could put an amber-colored beverage in the summertime after you pour a little water into this mug and put it into the freezer, nice and frosty, Boston Confidential tumbler. Also, we have some hoodies, a quarter zip, and t-shirts. Guys, the address for this shop is bostonconfidentialgear.com. That's bostonconfidentialgear.com. It's also linked on our website under store. Imagine that. Again, guys, I mentioned it's pothole season, which coincides directly with pollen season. So if I sound a little bit under the weather, I'm hoping it's just allergies. But guys, if you get a chance, check out the store, bostonconfidentialgear.com. And if anybody has any suggestions for products they may want to see in the store, feel free to email me at barry@bostonconfidential.net. That's barry@bostonconfidential.net. We've gotten a tremendous response to the store so far, and it's kind of heartwarming. A lot of people who've been with me since the beginning are buying something from the store to show their support. And going forward, guys, I think there's going to be some more opportunities to show your support for Boston Confidential. And I believe that will give us the financial wherewithal to do some more interesting things. I have some things in mind, but I don't want to reveal them just yet. But I think you'd be intrigued by them. Guys, we had a big response to our episode, our last live episode. That was the episode about the Heath Street Gang in Bromley Heath in Jamaica Plain, right over the line from Roxbury. Man, big response on that case. A lot of people writing in saying that gangs just like them should be taken off the street. And they're not the only one. Just over the hill is a huge gang in Mission Hill. So hopefully they're next. But seemingly the feds like to make a big splash and go away. And then the Boston police and the state police let it all just bubble back up again. But I guess we all have to do our part, right? So a lot of the emails were focused on the guy who did a shooting while out on probation or bail with an ankle bracelet on. Yes, it's true. An absolute criminal mastermind. They just tracked it back down to where the shooting was and boom. How about that? GPS positioning. And the guy who got pinched for it, I mean, he knows it. It's on his ankle. He doesn't think that they're going to track it back. It's so absurd. I mean, I know that little girl got shot, and that's a tragedy. It really is. But the probation guys and the cops must have been cracking up. I mean, you do a shooting with a GPS on your ankle. And that was one of the predicate counts of this RICO case, and it's big, it's federal. And the guy I just spoke of, he's looking at 35 years. But what I'm assuming is happening is everybody's cutting a deal on this, you know, and trying to get out from under whatever they can. Also, there's another update on a case we've covered here on Boston Confidential, and that's the case of Half and Suzanne Zantop out of Dartmouth, New Hampshire in 2001. One of the people that committed that bloody double murder, James Parker, who was 16 at the time of the murders in 2001, has been paroled. And I don't know. I don't know if this is good for society. And I don't know if it works as a complete deterrent to crime. But James Parker is getting out. And I was going to lead with saying that he was like the lesser player in that double homicide. But guys, this was brutal. It was a nasty, nasty home invasion, basically robbery, murder. They talked their way into the house and his partner, Robert Tulloch, started stabbing Half Zantop, who was, I believe, 58, and his wife tried to come to his aid. And this James Parker stopped her and cut her throat. So he's really not a lesser player. And I have very little sympathy for him. And I thought we'd never hear from these people again, but here we are. He served more than half his life in prison and has taken advantage, by all accounts, of the prison officials. He's taken advantage of every program under the sun. I don't know. I'm just conflicted on it. Robert Tulloch, who was 17 at the time, received life with no possibility of parole. The other kid, Parker, had received 25 to life. And so that's why he was up earlier for parole. And you think you'd never hear from this Robert Tulloch because it was all this guy Tulloch's idea. And they had plotted this and planned on killing people. Tulloch just wanted to kill people. I believe Parker was kind of a loser hanger-on. But man, it was bloody. But with Tulloch, he's filed for a resentencing hearing because there's this whole movement in the criminal justice system to basically pardon people who committed crimes as young adults because their brains aren't fully developed. That's BS in my book. They both deserve to go down for the dirt nap on that one. And read some of the details about that case or go back and listen to our episode on it. It's brutal, absolutely brutal. These two kids, everything in the world going for them. And they decide to kill two professors who are nearing retirement age for about $350. That's what they ended up getting out of it. All right, guys, let's get on to this week's episode. Again, we're covering the Karen Reed case, and I'm mesmerized by this case. And I said on the last Karen Reed update that we did, man, you're in the middle of a historical criminal justice moment here. And it's hard to realize that when you're in it. And I had previously equated it to the Klaus von Bülow case out of Newport, Rhode Island. And that case happened in the 1980s. And I think that kind of leads me to my first component I wanted to cover in this case is the media coverage in the Karen Reed case. You can directly contrast it to the Klaus von Bülow case, if you're old enough to remember that. That was headline news for, I don't know, a better part of a year. The media right now is just starting to cover this. The only person who had been covering this in depth on any level is Turtle Boy, Aiden Carney of Turtle Boy News. And I just saw something on Twitter that said today was the first anniversary of what he had published in his blog. So the first time this corruption or potential corruption was revealed was today, you know, last year by Turtle Boy. And I think the media gave it a good leaving alone because they don't like Aiden Carney and they hate the fact that he ran circles around them in this case. That's why they've given this case a good leaving alone. They don't want to seem to be on the side of Turtle Boy. And it's weird because I don't understand it. If you're looking for clicks or views on your website or social media, if you're a media company, the Boston Herald, the Boston Globe, you'd send somebody to cover this case, but they haven't. And I'm sorry, everybody points to Ted Daniels of Fox 25 in this case. His reporting on this has been so bland. It's just so milquetoast. He's afraid to take any position on anything. It's kind of cowardly, in my opinion. So that's my thoughts on it, why they haven't covered this case. I think there's another component to the media coverage in the Karen Reed case is they don't have any personnel. You know, we don't have Michelle McPhee anymore doing investigative reporting. We don't have Howie Carr doing investigative reporting anymore. There's so few investigative reporters, I had to look some up. And the names that came up, man, they were good reporters. Stephen Kirkjanian out of the Globe, Kevin Cullen on some level. I mean, they used to do these types of stories. But what happens is, currently, I believe the reporter just calls the court clerk. Whatever they tell them, they run with. It's lazy, inefficient, and it does nothing for your dying newspaper industry. And I know I've said this before. Go out and pick up a copy of the Boston Globe, the Boston Herald. There's nothing in it anymore. The last opportunity at the barbershop I had, I picked up a Herald. And if it was 15 pages, it was a lot. No advertising, no reporting. They seemingly just take the word of whomever they're covering, be it the mayor of Boston or the governor of Massachusetts. No digging. I guess that's all over. And I guess you combine that with not wanting to align yourself with Turtle Boy. It gives you this dearth of information we've had for over a year on this case. Most people are in the dark on it, and the only way they know about it was from Aidan Carney of Turtle Boy News and what happened to him while he was beating the bushes on this case. He had been arrested for witness intimidation, and some of the charges include asking a state trooper questions while he was on duty leaving court. You get charged with witness intimidation for asking an armed state police trooper a question about a murder case he's involved in? He's an armed, trained state police trooper, and you're going to intimidate him coming out of a courtroom? Another count Aidan is charged with is going to a witness's house, she may be more than that, and knocking on the door. Asking questions. That's what reporters used to do. Maybe people forget that, but there is footage all over the United States of reporters doing just that. And if that's witness intimidation, let me tell you what happened today at the courthouse. Today they're filling jurors' seats, and I think they're about done. But there's one goofball who claims he's a reporter by the name of Grant something or other. As Karen Reed is getting out of her vehicle with her attorney, Alan Jackson, the so-called reporter, asks her directly, are you sleeping with your attorney, Karen? Did you guys spend a night in the hotel together? That's the question you're interested in, and you think other people want to hear the answer? You're just a fool, and this guy Grant is the son of Wendy Murphy, who used to be a well-respected attorney serving women's rights in Boston. And she was always a very hard charger for women's rights. But she's kind of disfigured herself with some crazy plastic surgery. And on this case, this Wendy Murphy goes on several news shows and kind of beclowns herself. And it's kind of sad to see. And to say that Grant's her son, it doesn't astonish me at all. But somebody had brought to my attention that, you know, Wendy Murphy was all gung-ho on that Duke LaCrosse case. She wanted those lacrosse kids, the whole team strung up by their thumbs. And just a few months later, it came out that the allegations against the Duke lacrosse players were totally fabricated. And I believe the so-called victim in that case faced charges for lying. But I never heard a mea culpa from Wendy Murphy on it, so don't hold your breath. So guys, that brings me to the online aspect of this case. Twitter is crazy for the Karen Reed case. If you're interested, hop on over. Man, I've never seen anything like it. One cat's got a show on there. I hate to highlight it, but Yellow Cottage Tales, man, it's just devoid of any tether to reality. This guy, I don't know, a few months ago did this kind of quasi-accident reconstruction, not with an SUV, and it's the most cartoonish, absurd thing I've seen. If you were in the fifth grade and came up with that, I may give you a B on your grade. But this guy who runs the Yellow Cottage show stated that that recreation convinced him that Karen Reed was guilty. And from that point on, he just wasn't hearing anything in the other direction. I've checked in on it, but it's so ludicrous. I can't stay for much of it. And anybody who comes up with a counter argument is immediately dismissed in the strangest manner. It is just not fact-based at all. He can't come to any conclusion. Like when you see those taillights fully intact at 5 a.m. and they're already supposed to be on the lawn at the crime scene, he just throws up his hands and basically says the cops wouldn't lie. That's what everybody on the Karen Reed is guilty or I support the Commonwealth side. It's basically just the cops wouldn't lie. But it's already been proven in this case that they've lied because they've had to go to a corruption inquiry at the grand jury because they've lied. And so it's like a circular argument. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. They say, oh, the cops wouldn't lie. And you say to them, well, Michael Proctor had to admit to the fact that he is friends with these witnesses on the stand for a federal grand jury investigating him for corruption. And they're like, yeah, the cops wouldn't lie. I'm like, you're just dense. At that point, you're just dense. And if you think the police won't lie in a case like this, where were you with the FBI in Boston during the Whitey Bulger days? They lied right to your face for 35 years. So this guy, Grant, and a few others, they're just really anti-Turtle Boy, Aiden Carney, you know? And they just beclown themselves on a daily basis. I'll debate facts with anybody at any time, but it all on that side boils down to the cops wouldn't lie. Well, why did the cops interview everybody all grouped together? Well, the cops wouldn't lie. Sometimes after, you know, it was snowing out. Or why didn't they interview the plow driver for more than a year? Why did they have to interview the actual plow driver the day after Aiden Carney of Turtle Boy News interviewed him? Right? And it was at that point, I believe, that it became apparent that the FBI was involved in this case because the plow driver told Aiden that he had already spoken to the FBI. It was around that time. It had been bubbling up for quite some time. But the Karen Reed is guilty faction just says the cops wouldn't lie. That's their retort to everything. And look at this from a 10,000-foot overview. If you don't come up saying that there's something wrong in this investigation, you're just out of your mind. And I apologize a little bit, guys. I've been trying to give the online stuff, the Wendy Murphy, Grant, I try to steer clear of it because it's just so base. You know what I mean? And that's what I advise Aiden Carney to do. Don't give these people any oxygen. But sometimes it's difficult, like that goofball blurting out those, you know, sexual questions to an attorney and a client going in for her own murder trial. You don't have the brain cells to formulate a better question than that. You waited all week for that one question. Guys, I'm finishing recording this on April 20th. So, geez, isn't that the anniversary of Columbine? There's a few seats left to be filled by jurors in this case. They moved a little quicker than I thought they would. And the trial will continue on Monday. And I think we should have a jury seated by Tuesday, Wednesday at the latest. But one of my problems in this case is I simply don't understand it. I wish I had an attorney I could ask some quick questions to, because the Commonwealth has not finished discovery. They're still trying to admit this piece of evidence. I believe originally it was found not to be a human hair, but it was a hair-like piece of evidence on the bumper of Karen Reed's car. And they sent it back out for testing again. The trial started, and I think originally the judge said, well, them's the breaks. But now she's saying in open court that she'll consider it when the testing's done. I believe you can't do that. I mean, there's a deadline for discovery because the defense has to formulate a defense to that particular piece of evidence. But I wouldn't put it past Judge Beverly to admit this into evidence. I believe that would be grounds for an appeal. I think there are many avenues to appeal in this case over and over again. And I'm not going to state them. They should be obvious to you at this point, I think. So one of the things that came out this week is the witness list for both the prosecution and defense. And the defense lists are pretty aggressive. They called the same company that did the forensic testing for the FBI that was released through that TUI report. Man, this is a highly educated group of people who are going to testify that the murder weapon was something other than the vehicle. And the way it was relayed in the TUI report was John O'Keefe's injuries are not consistent with being hit by a car. Second, Karen Reed's vehicle did not strike John O'Keefe. So in my humble estimation, that simply takes away your murder weapon. So this company that was hired by the FBI to conduct this forensic examination, the business name is Design Research Engineering, and they're specialists in accident scene investigation. I'll put a link to it. Turtle Boy has a good outlay on it in his blog, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Man, just reviewing these people's credentials makes me feel stupid. They're so highly educated. I don't know how the prosecution's going to counter this, and I wonder if they'll even try. I think they're going through the motions here because it's hard for anybody with a brain at this point to come to the conclusion that they're going to get a conviction in this case. I believe Karen is factually innocent. I believe this was a setup, and it's coming undone right now. And I feel a little strange about it because I know the FBI is corrupt. And I'll point to the Whitey Bulger days and you'll come back and say, Barry, come on, that ended in the 90s. Well, maybe for the Winter Hill Gang, it ended in the 90s. But for a former president, it continued. They were attempting to frame a president, right? We know that. That's a fact. That came out in the Comey report. You saw what they did to the victims of Whitey Bulger. They fought tooth and nail not to give them a dime. And it took years for those victims of Whitey Bulger and the FBI to get a check from the government. It's just absurd, but we have them coming in, and I guess we have to take them on this on a factual basis. And it kind of brings me to the conclusion, if this all goes the way we think it will, are you going to have the same type of feelings for the Mass State Police? Because if that TUI report is correct, if the engineering firm is correct, guys, that means a member of law enforcement brought those taillights to the crime scene. You dig? Do you see how big that is? If you believe the engineering firm, you have to believe that there's corruption in this case. Also, the defense is calling the Lopolito brothers. And if that name sounds like a blast from the past, the beginning of this case, it's because it is. These two brothers got into some street beef with Chris Albert. And Chris Albert goes running to Officer Michael Lank, who was nearby drinking at a bar, and saying he just was assaulted by these two brothers. Lank gets into a street beef with the brothers, ends up arresting him. He's a Canton police officer, and this is 2002. And Michael Lank arrested them. These two brothers sued the department and won a huge settlement, but nothing happened, as far as I can see, in terms of discipline to Michael Lank, because he went from patrolman to sergeant to lieutenant, and he is currently a lieutenant detective on the Canton Police Department. So beating the crap out of those two guys and lying about it didn't really harm his career at all. Are you surprised? So Lieutenant Lank has a history of going out of his way, and some would say breaking the law, to protect the Albert family. And who is one of the first people to arrive at Brian Albert's house during that morning John O'Keefe was killed? Michael Lank. He is the only person, the only law enforcement person that I can see through all these reports that entered the home on any level. Did he go down to the basement? Who knows? But he went in there because he knows these people. And after Lank goes into the house, Brian Albert and his wife, Nicole, never exit to try to help. Can you imagine that? First responders in the house and your friend's dead on the lawn. And you shut the lights out like it's Halloween and you're out of candy. Also on the witness list, guys, are two Boston cops who weren't there that evening. One by the name of Stephen Ridge, and I believe Patrolman Ridge was on that TV show with Brian Albert, Boston's Finest or something like that. And Herbito Eddie Hernandez. Officer Hernandez also worked on that task force or unit with Brian Albert, and it is said that Brian Albert got into a street beef at a police party with Hernandez. So what they're doing there is they're setting the scene for this third party culprit defense, because they're gonna say Brian Albert's a violent bastard. And I believe Hernandez, at a minimum, is going to have to concur with that. The plow driver, Lucky Laughlin, is on that list. And he's going to tell you that he wasn't approached by the Mass State Police until a year later, like the day after Aiden Carney posted on his blog, Turtle Boy News, that he had spoken to Laughlin. And Laughlin had told Aiden Carney that he saw nobody on the lawn at Fairview at 2:30 a.m. And he was up and down that street plowing, and his lights went right over that area, and he saw nobody, but he did see a Ford Edge parked nearby. And he'll testify, I believe, to the fact that no Canton police or state police contacted him until Aiden Carney's story came out. And he'll further testify that the FBI did. They did track him down, and he did speak with them, because this is when it really broke that the FBI was interviewing witnesses in this case. And he told them the same thing. There was no body on the lawn. And don't forget all those other witnesses who stated that they left also saw no body. The witnesses who left the house earlier, you know, after 12:30, the body's supposed to be on the lawn sometime between just after 12:30 and what, 6 a.m. Hence the inquiry, how long to die in the cold, to Google, right? But the body wasn't there. The case just gets shakier and shakier as we go. And just to recap from the previous hearings, guys, some bombshells were dropped. Again, I know I covered it during the last Karen Reed update case, but it was revealed that Brian Albert and Brian Higgins, who's an ATF agent who was at this party, had communicated after they had told people, right? After they had told the grand jury that they spoke to no one else. So they lied to the grand jury. And more than that, guys, they tried to lie to the federal grand jury. At least Higgins did. Higgins tried to say that their communication, you know, just about, I think it was like 2:25 a.m., that communication was a butt dial. But on the stand, according to the defense, Brian Higgins had to admit, no, it was a legitimate phone call, because you can't really butt dial people, you know, that much anymore. You've got to put your code in or your fingerprint, press the button. And he did finally admit that on the stand. So what were you talking about? That came minutes before Jen McCabe's 2:27 a.m. Google search, how long to die in the cold, right? And also, these two witnesses destroyed their cell phones. And I'm just going to say, innocent people don't destroy their phones. They don't destroy their phones. Brian Higgins took his phone to a military base on Cape Cod, snapped the SIM card, and destroyed the rest of the phone. Brian Albert also destroyed his phone. What's going on? How are they going to explain that? They're not. And it came out during the previous hearing, not this week, that Brian Higgins had a proffer. And a proffer on the federal level means, you know, you're going to tell us everything in search of a deal. If we decide not to give you a deal on whatever crimes we're proposing to charge you with, we won't use the information you provided in the proffer. But that means he's dealing. And I believe a deal has already been made, because another Albert, who is on the police department, the Canton Police Department, went to Higgins and said, hey, you're scaring everybody. Everybody else got a subpoena to the federal grand jury except you. Everybody's been trying to call you. And he's went radio silent, you know. And I think the federal government told him to do just that. So it'll be interesting to see how the Brian Higgins and Brian Albert fiasco plays out. Also revealed in that week's testimony was the fact that Michael Proctor's sister had texted him saying, I just saw Julie Albert, who is Chris Albert's wife. And Julie Albert said to Michael Proctor's sister, they want to get you a gift when this is all over. And again, I know I've repeated this. He had an opportunity to say, whoa, hold on a minute. That would be a bribe. I can't take it. Or I did nothing out of the ordinary. No. He says, give it to my wife. And the defense is going to run a bus through that because it's a bribe. What are you accepting gifts for if Karen Reed is guilty? Are you with me? And this is where the Karen Reed is guilty crowd loses all credibility, because they can't answer that simple question. Why does Michael Proctor need a gift if Karen Reed is guilty? The simple question for Michael Proctor on the stand is, why would you accept a gift? Is that within the state police rules that you accept gifts for fixing cases. I can't believe this guy is still working homicides. But again, the state police are in a sticky wicket with Proctor, right? Because he has his hands not only in the Karen Reed case, but in several other high-profile homicide cases. I think Turtle Boy stated that Michael Proctor just made an arrest in a homicide in Weymouth, Massachusetts. I can't tell you how bad the state police look in all this. And they come off as they don't care. You know, they really just don't give a shit what you think of them. But if I was the governor, I'd have the state police colonel in my office and tell him to explain this to me right now. But it's Massachusetts, and if that occurred, the governor would have to act. And that's the last thing politicians want to do. I almost forgot to tell you guys, this case is so crazy that I'll forget some of it, right? But Michael Morrissey, the district attorney of Norfolk County, is being called as a witness in this case. And I've mentioned this in previous Karen Reed episodes. And they're doing that because he made this crazy videotaped or television broadcast where he tried to bolster the witnesses. Highly unethical. He basically said the witnesses were telling the truth and that Michael Proctor didn't have a relationship with the witnesses in the case. And at least 50% of that is absolute garbage. And if the defense can prove that Michael Morrissey knew that before he released that crazy segment on television, I think he's in trouble. He may be in trouble anyway. He may be the target or one of the targets of this federal investigation. And again, it's also been theorized, guys, I know I'm all over the place here, that after jury selection is complete, that's when double jeopardy attaches to this case. If the federal government was going to do something like maybe make an arrest in this case, that may be the time to do it, because if they come out with Michael Proctor in handcuffs, I don't see how the state police case can go forward. Actually, it couldn't. And again, you may have people, as it is, if this does go forward next week, you may have people taking the Fifth Amendment, state's witnesses, not defense witnesses. Brian Albert, he may take the Fifth, right? Because he could be facing a murder beef. And if you were his attorney, would you allow him to get into an area where he could compromise himself? Jen McCabe may be taking the Fifth Amendment as well, because how do you explain that Google search at 2:27 a.m.? How long to die in the cold? And then she went ahead and deleted her phone library. Again, that's consciousness of guilt. Destroying your phones. Brian Albert, Brian Higgins, that's consciousness of guilt. That's something that innocent people don't do. They just don't do it. And I believe you're going to hear from Brian Higgins. I don't know if you're going to hear from Brian Albert, and I don't know if you're going to hear from Jen McCabe, because how can they? I got to wrap it up here, guys, but as I conclude, man, it just breaks my heart into a million pieces seeing the fact that the district attorney's office and the police are not the good guys, right? I'd expect you in this case to flip reality where the defense is doing anything to get their client out of a life sentence. But that's not the case. The defense is asking for more video. They wanted the Ring cameras from across the street. They requested the library video where Jen drove past. Guess what? It's missing. They requested the Canton Police Department's garage video. 42 seconds of that is missing, the exculpatory part of it. How are they going to explain this, right? You may have gotten away with, okay, yeah, the library camera, it was just an error, but there's not two errors in the same framework, right? Getting video. And Michael Proctor is going to take an absolute beating on the stand. And I think after his testimony, this case will largely be over. But man, it's a heartbreaker to just see the police activity in this, that it's not straight and narrow. This guy Proctor was open to taking a bribe. How is he still on active duty? How and why did the district attorney's office allow the phones to be destroyed? Brian Albert and Brian Higgins, they destroyed their phones with the blessing of Michael Morrissey, the district attorney in this case. That's not the activities of a legitimate investigation. Have you ever heard of that happening before? Witnesses destroying their phones and they go ahead with the case against the defendant? These are cops. They were told to retain those phones and in direct defiance of a court order decided to smash them. That means there was some massively incriminating evidence on those phones. I got to tell you, it damages how people see the police department and the district attorney's office. Again, they're supposed to be for truth, justice, in the American way, but they're destroying phones. You dig? All right, guys, I'm going to have to leave you there. I know this gets a little repetitive at times, but it's such a big case. Jury selection will continue. I believe they only need to seat the alternate jurors. I think that's all that's left. They wanted four alternates, and that'll probably happen Monday or Tuesday. And then I think the trial will go a little faster after that, but who knows? All right, guys, don't forget our store, BostonConfidentialGear.com. That's BostonConfidentialGear.com. And if you need to get a hold of me, email's the best platform, Barry@BostonConfidential.net. Barry@BostonConfidential.net. And we'll see what next week brings on this crazy case. All right, guys, I'll see you on the flip side.